For almost 2,500 years, doctors have recited the Hippocratic Oath. It says, in part,
I swear I will use treatment to help the sick, according to my ability and judgment, but never with a view to injury and wrongdoing. I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art. In whatsoever houses I enter, I will enter to help the sick, and I will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm. This is Second Sunday. Tonight, Medicine, Part 2, Medical Care.
Good evening. I'm Dean Mell. In April, Second Sunday, a monthly NBC radio network series which is devoted this year to the revolution that marks our civilization today, reviewed medicine, the science of life. We did not explore the unique nor tomorrow's promise. Rather, we undertook a generous review of what medical science can do now as a matter of daily course, wherever you live, whenever you are ill. Essentially, what emerged was what most of us have long suspected, that medicine has scored profound advances in helping us through illness, beginning, when necessary, treatment before birth, and not ceasing until that ultimate moment when all science must bow, the moment of death. Now, Second Sunday continues its review of medicine today. Our objectives are simply to look at medical care, its cost, its quality, its availability. In other words, we'll review how medical science is translated into medical treatment and what it costs. This will not attempt a total nor definitive study of medical care, but we will probe some elements that make up its cost and treatment. Now, here are some statistics.
Between 1950 and 1965, the general cost of living jumped almost a third, or 31.2%. In 1950, the average charge by a doctor for a house call was $5. In 1967, it was $9.57, and fewer doctors were making house calls. In 1950, the national average cost of a visit in a doctor's office was $3.25. In 1967, the price had increased to $6. In 1951, the Journal of Medical Economics said the median net income before taxes for all doctors in the nation was $13,150 a year. In 1966, the average doctor's income was $32,170 a year. The American doctor today has the highest annual income of any professional in the world.
In other words, while the cost of living has leaped by one-third, doctors' charges and incomes have doubled and tripled. But there are more interesting statistics connected with medicine.
In 1949, the average annual income for a full-time nurse was $2,460. In 1967, the nurse's annual income was $6,100. In 1950, it cost $15.62 for a one-day stay in a general hospital. This year, the cost is in excess of $40 a day.
Medicine is a staggeringly expensive proposition when compared with the past. Its costs are climbing and the end is not in sight. Why? What about the quality of today's medicine and its availability? It is in these areas that we will concern ourselves tonight. Let us look at hospital costs. In Cleveland, NBC newsman Joe Mossbrook talked about medical economics with Dr. John Grady, president of the Cleveland Academy of Medicine.
What are some of the reasons for this rapid rise in medical care cost?
Well, there has been an increase in doctors' fees, I think starting back about 3 years ago, when we realized that usual and customary fees were going to be the mode of payment by third-party insurers. And as far as the cost of hospital care is concerned, I think the biggest factor here has been the attitude of the nursing personnel in seeking and getting an adequate wage after many years of being underpaid. And with the raise in the nursing salaries, the paramedical personnel concomitantly take an increase of 10, 15, or 20%. And then the minimum wage law again affected some of the paramedical personnel in the hospitals, and all of these factors contribute to the increase in hospital costs.
The relationship of hospital costs to the individual was pinpointed by Merle Paulus, NBC News Pittsburgh, in an interview with Tom Callahan, Director, Hospital Council of Western Pennsylvania.
How much time in a lifetime does the average person spend in a hospital?
I think probably a little bit more than people realize. Statistically, one out of every seven people in this country will go to a hospital this year for some length of stay. This means that in a period of 7 years, statistically, everyone in the country will have spent some time in a hospital. And based on our current life expectancy rates, you figure that every human being in this country will have 10 different visitations to the hospital, ranging from 2 to maybe 20 days at a time. So you might say that the average person, if there is such a thing, is going to spend somewhere between 4 and 5 months of his lifetime as a hospital patient.
How much of his income will he spend on that?
I don't think there's a good clear-cut answer for that. Under current standards, the average cost of care is about $50 a day. That's $1,500 a month. That's around $6,000, $7,000 a year.
To the average ill person, medical economics is a matter of a doctor's bill and his hospital bill, with medical insurance helping pay the costs. To a hospital, however, illness is big business. The Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh has 700 beds, 1,500 employees, 4 buildings, the main building 18 stories high. It represents big money. How big? Merle Paulus talked with the hospital's administrator, Lad Grupsky, about the cost of operating such a facility.
What kind of money does it take to run this hospital on a day-by-day basis?
Well, it'd be hard for me to divide $365 into $13 million, but it costs us in excess of $1 million per month to operate the hospital. Of this $1 million per month, we spend about 70% of that money, in other words, $700,000, for staff and employees' salaries. The other 30% is for the maintenance, for supply, for purchase of equipment, and items such as this.
What is a hospital? To a citizen of a metropolitan center, it is a handy medical complex a few miles from home, complete with laboratories of all types, miles of corridors, dozens of efficient employees, and at the end of his illness, a trip to a cashier's office as big and coldly efficient as a bank. On the other hand, there are hundreds of towns in rural America without even a first aid station. Tens of thousands of Americans live in towns that consider themselves lucky because they at least have a doctor with some sort of hospital facility to back him up. For them, the general practitioner still is the man of medicine. One such town is Jellico, Tennessee, a somnolent, dying coal mine town of some 1,500 people. Its only doctor is Charles Prater. Newsman Jim Miller of station WATE Nashville drove over to Jellico.
Dr. Prater owns and operates his own hospital. It's a rambling old house built in the early 1900s of the style so common in these small southern towns. It was once the residence of a coal baron, but was turned into the community hospital about 30 years ago. We visited the Jellico Hospital and went on a walking tour with Dr. Prater.
Doctor, how many people do you see a day?
To a varying degree, an average day would be from 75 to 100 or more patients a day.
What would you say your average work day?
My average work day is around 18 hours.
Do you make house calls, doctor?
I make no house calls except on a few old people who are unable to come to the hospital now.
How many patients would you estimate that you treat a year in this hospital?
Approximately 2,000 a year.
How many people are you able to keep here overnight?
We have a bed capacity of 32 beds. They have an occupancy of between 75 and 85%. Of this number, approximately 35% at the present time have been Medicare patients.
And do you see them all personally yourself?
Yes, any of those that come through these portals are seen by me.
How many employees do you have in your hospital?
We have approximately 50 employees.
Can we walk up this ramp? Where does this go? Yeah.
This ramp leads to the second floor.
Now, what's this room, Doctor?
This is the surgical room.
How often would you use this room in the course of a week?
It would vary, sometime as many as 30 to 40 times a week.
And you do it all yourself?
There's no one else. You have to do it yourself.
Dr. Prater's patients seem to have that sort of idealized faith in him that is often missing from offices of big city specialists to whom a growing number of patients are referred. Miller chatted with one of Dr. Prater's patients.
And you're Mr. Vandenberg, Keller.
What's your age, sir?
68. Owned December 20th, 18 and 99.
How long have you been coming to Dr. Prater?
Well, ever since he's been in this hospital.
Would you go to another doctor, sir?
No, sirree. Not if I could get here to Prater. Nor my wife either, nor none of the rest of us at home.
You all depend on Jellicoe Hospital?
I sure have, yes.
On the very high end of the spectrum is the posh medical facility where the very rich suffer in as much comfort as possible. One such is a wing of the Washington Hospital Center in Washington, D.C. NBC News reporter Charles Woolsey took a walking tour of the luxurious hospital with its assistant administrator, David Musgrave.
Now, in entering this room, we find a carpet. We find a rather large sofa. You find what looks like a standard hospital bed, but it's very unobtrusive in the room as such. It looks like a large china closet there. There are paintings on the walls. Now, are these...
Chuck, I have to correct you on that china closet. That's an armoire in which we have the television hid.
You can't see the television, but I assume you open the doors. Is that
remote-controlled
also?
It is, right by the bedside.
Is it possible to live in a VIP suite?
Well, that's a generous term. Actually, all suites have a little kitchenette. We, for example, at breakfast time, the eggs are cooked in the kitchen and brought into the patient, and the toast is made in his kitchenette so it'll arrive at just the right time, at the right temperature, and so on. There's a little refrigerator here for that ice cube that might be needed, which I'm sure has been used many times.
We are now in the kitchen of the VIP ward. What's on the menu today, Dave?
Well, I have for dinner four appetizers, French onion soup, fresh fruit cup, smoked salmon, V8 juice. In the entrees, you've got broiled lamb chops, loin lamb, broiled filet mignon, lobster tail, pork chop, stuffed with wild rice, breast of turkey, beef stroganoff. And you can see there's a selection of desserts as well and salads. We have a wine list here, providing the doctor agrees that the patient may have wine.
What would it cost me to spend a day in this VIP suite as a patient?
Anywhere from 154 to 169, depending on your choice of room.
There is no precise way to define a hospital, except to say perhaps it is a well-equipped place to treat illnesses, all illnesses of the spirit as well as the flesh, of infancy as well as age. Increasing numbers of Americans today live in old folks' homes, where except for terminal illness, all the aches and pains of age are treated. In Chicago, Ray James, NBC News, discussed the problems of these quasi-medical facilities with Jack Gold, vice president of the Chicago Jewish Home for the Aged.
Frankly, the amount of people who come in here come in for their specific reasons. Some state of dependency is exhibited because they need support, protection, and help from somebody else. The people who go to the institutions usually do that because they want to go. And when they come into a home for the aged, we put additional blocks in their path to make sure that they really want to come here.
In a lot of cases, however, isn't it where the children no longer want the responsibility of caring for them and insist that they go into the home rather than they're just volunteering to come to a home?
If one of these people, in response to the social worker's question, says, "I don't want to come into the home," it doesn't make any difference what the children say. The person must want to come in here because we'll find that these people can turn into themselves and commit suicide. I don't mean that they take a gun or they take a pill. They can commit internal suicide. And this is sometimes evidenced by the people who go into these shock states, who go into the senile withdrawal state, the people who become, so to speak, the vegetables in the institution. some of our programs now that we've started, which show greater attention to these people and treat them like human beings, have drawn them out of these old, withdrawn, depressed attitudes, these isolated states, and have made them human beings again. Our rehabilitation program is motivated in the desire of getting people to come in. This should be an open-end facility. As easy as it is to come in, it should be that easy for the people to leave. We don't want people to think of this as a human warehouse. We don't want people to come in here necessarily to stay until the angel of death taps them on the shoulder. Our ambition here is to create within these people sufficient incentive, sufficient good body capacity so that they can go out. And the thing that obsesses old people, and sometimes it's subconscious, it's not really on the conscious level all the time, is the three decrements of aging: aloneness, uselessness, and illness. And if we can show these people that they are somebody and that they needn't be alone, and if we can show them that they are useful, that they can do certain chores, and if we can repair whatever is their handicap or disability or overcome their disease, they could live out in the community. The whole point about this is the want on the part of the individual to live. If he gets any kind of an idea that his life is useless, he is already beginning to commit internal suicide.
To those to whom the future is measured in swiftly passing finite years, what is life in such a home?
Well, how about your health generally? You're looking real good. Do you feel good?
I feel wonderful if my leg was all right. If I can only walk again.
Well, you're just using a little walker. You seem to be walking all right.
Well, that isn't sufficient.
Is that one of the reasons why you decided to come here?
Well, I was getting kind of nobody to shop and do things for me. And being a little bit of independent, I didn't want to be obligated to anybody. Therefore, I thought that the best thing I can do is to come into a place where I'll be taken care of for the rest of my life.
Tell me why you decided to come in here, Mr. Gold, rather than just retire in an apartment or a house.
Well, it's a long story, but I'll cut it short. It's because of my wife's illness. She's mentally senile. And I tried to keep her at home for about 5 years before I came here, but I saw the struggle was too big for me, and I decided to close shop and come here. In fact, my dad passed away here in 46, so I knew what the place was like then, from then on.
Mrs. Elman, how long have you been here, a resident at home?
Six years in August.
Why did you decide to come here rather than just retire in an apartment?
Mrs. Blumenthal asked me the same question when I came in. I told her I need a home and security. I was a very sick woman. And by being sick, I start to feel depressed. And I saw a psychiatrist. And since then, I didn't see a psychiatrist. Since I'm here.
Since you've been here, you haven't needed a psychiatrist. You haven't felt despondent at all.
Very nice. And I'm very glad because I think everything what I've given me here is exactly what we need. People, what they need, a home and care. All my friends warned me not to go on a hold on. And I said, I'm going because I need help. And you know what they say now? That I'm the smart one.
1 out of every 10 of us will need psychiatric help sometime in our lives. 1 out of every 100 will be hospitalized for mental illness. Dr. William L. Grover, administrator of the Cleveland State Mental Hospital, discussed the quality of care in a better state mental institution with Joe Mossbrook, NBC News, Cleveland.
What's wrong with mental care in our mental hospitals? What are the glaring weaknesses?
Well, I think there are several. I think the basic one is still there, and that is that the average citizen really doesn't give a damn about what happens in mental health because he doesn't think it's going to happen to him. It's going to happen to you or me or someone else. And I think this is really at the basis of the whole thing. Because if he did, I think he would be insisting that more be done for patients in hospitals. He would also be willing to pay the bill. And in this connection, I doubt if any of the states are spending an adequate amount of money on this. Another glaring difficulty is the shortage of trained professional personnel. This is throughout the country. And this leads to a sort of situation where one state will raise salaries and steal folks from an adjacent state, and someone else raises them again, and it's just this never-ending spiral attempting to attract an inadequate number of people adequately trained in the first place.
Isn't the cost of good mental care prohibitive for the average person, say for a man or his wife raising a family?
Well, if we're talking about the cost of care in the private psychiatric hospital or in the psychiatric section of a general hospital, it's rather high. It's whatever the daily cost would be in the general hospital, unless you have Blue Cross or some other form of hospitalization insurance, you just can't afford it. And I'm talking about hospital only. This doesn't count the professional services that are involved.
What might the daily cost be?
Well, this might run anywhere from $40 to $75 a day or more, depending on the area of the country.
What is it here at Cleveland State?
The per diem here is around $6 per day. That $6 per day includes the professional care, too, not just the hospital part of it. The person whom we receive in our state institutions, and I'm sure this is true throughout the country, are those who can't afford to go to private institutions.
And how about the patient in today's state hospital? Does he feel trapped in a deadly snake pit? Joe Mossbrook talked to one man of his care and his feelings.
How are you being treated here?
Good. At the last part, when I first come here, I wasn't being treated good, but eventually, along with it's got better.
Why the change, do you think?
Well, when I first was brought here, I was put on the worst wards there was, and I wasn't treated good with the attendants, and wasn't treated good by the patients. And I eventually got transferred to better wards, and I started getting better myself. And they wasn't beating me around and kicking me around like that they wanted to do on the first ward that I come here, and that was Ward F. They wanted to beat me and kick me around, and I wouldn't let them.
Are you ever treated in a mean way now?
No.
What about the members of the staff? How do they treat you?
Good.
Do you have a pleasant room?
No, sir.
It isn't pleasant?
Well, not pleasant.
What's it like?
Well, naturally, it's not like being home. No. Because there's no place like being at home.
The largest complex of medical services and facilities in the nation is the one run by the Veterans Administration. The VA maintains 166 hospitals, 38 of them devoted to psychiatric care. 26 million living war veterans are eligible for VA care, and about 4 million are helped each year. On any given day, VA hospitals are caring for 97,000 patients, with about 13,000 empty beds in reserve. The chief medical director of the Veterans Administration is Dr. H. Martin Engel, who discussed the cost, quality, and availability of VA medical care with NBC News correspondent Neil Boggs.
Many civilian hospitals, we're told, have almost reached the crisis stage in terms of availability of beds, of medical personnel, of hospital staff, and so forth. Do Veterans Administration facilities have that same problem?
Well, despite the increasing number of veterans eligible for VA care, despite the Vietnam conflict and the increase engendered by this, we're able to get by with fewer beds today than were required 10 years ago.
Has Vietnam put any new pressures on you?
Well, we're getting an increasing number of cases transferred from military hospitals to VA hospitals. A monthly total of about 350 such cases, in contrast to an average of maybe 40 or 50 cases a month a year and a half or 2 years ago.
Sometimes there are waiting periods for patients getting in civilian hospitals. Does that same situation exist with the VA hospitals?
The waiting list problem has decreased tremendously. 4 years ago, we had a waiting list of about 12,000 veterans who were in need of care in psychiatric hospitals. Currently, this total is now some 2,000.
Dollar for dollar, does a patient in a veterans hospital get more in the way of treatment and care than in a civilian hospital?
Our per diem costs in the Veterans Administration are significantly less than published per diems in community hospitals. But to be fair about it, cost accounting techniques vary, and we're dealing with a different kind of patient.
Medical care is involved with the patient at many levels. One is the welfare level. Today, the welfare patient no longer is an object of a doctor's willingness to practice charitable medicine. The welfare patient usually seeks assistance at the outpatient clinic of a hospital. There is a somewhat truthful saying that the only people who can afford excellent medical care are the very rich, to whom money is no problem, and the very poor, for whom the state pays every cost. This is only partially true. The very rich often misspend money for a status hospital rather than for excellent care. The very poor have access to free facilities, but they are not necessarily given the close supervision of a paying patient. I talked with several welfare patients at an outpatient clinic about their care in a slum hospital in Upper Manhattan.
When you come to emergency, sometimes they're so slow, it about take you 2 or 3 hours for them to wait on you. You could be dead by that time, because my hand was cut almost to the bone. It took them about 2 or 3 hours before they waited on me.
Have you any other experiences here at the hospital?
Yeah, my baby got her head busted open. It took me about an hour to sit out in the emergency. Then they took me in. I thought they was going to call me then, but they didn't call me. They told me to sit down there and wait. So I waited about 2 hours around and sitting on the bench for the doctor.
Were you pleased that you got good medical care once you got to see him?
Yeah, I was pleased.
Are you satisfied with the treatment that you get?
Well, I think the day was swell. The service we got today was wonderful. This child has a rash on his face, and I wanted to find out why. So I brought him over, and I didn't have no trouble. I didn't have to wait.
Do you think the treatment you get here is taking care of your problem?
Well, you have to wait so long, you know, if they get waited on, they take their own time. Then you have to come down and stay, wait for your medicine, stuff like that.
What's the longest you've ever had to wait for a treatment?
I came out here 1 hour, I was sick, and I had to wait 2 hours and still didn't get waited on.
Waited for 2 hours and still didn't get waited on?
That's right.
If there was anything you could change about the way the clinic is being run or the hospital care that's available?
The whole hospital included? Tear it down and build it up again.
Why do you say that?
The walls is cracking. Like, I've been here one time to see my friends, and it was crowded or something, and they had her out on something. It wasn't in the room. They had her out in the hall, and I wouldn't stay out in the hall. I'd rather leave and go home and stay in my bed. Have roaches in here, too. And when the rats don't bother me, but the roaches kills me.
We'll be back in a moment with more on today's medical care, including talks with the president of the American Medical Association, Dr. Dwight Wilbur, and Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Wilbur Cohen.
And now, Second Sunday. Here is Dean Mell.
In an era when the merchant cheat, the exorbitant claim, and the fast buck seem to take precedence in our lives, there is a nagging fear among many that doctors are not reluctant to take advantage of medical ignorance to perform unnecessary operations. Merle Paulus talked about this particular fear with Dr. Paul Lewis in Pittsburgh.
Doctor, many people feel that doctors operate unnecessarily many times just for the financial gain of performing the operation.
I have heard that charge many times myself, but I'm afraid the public isn't quite aware of the strict degree of internal self-policing that goes on in medical staffs of hospitals. Every hospital that is accredited by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals, and any hospital of any quality is, has to maintain certain internal self-disciplinary measures, among which, for instance, is a tissue committee. For every surgical procedure that's carried out in that hospital, the tissue that is removed is subject to scrutiny by the pathologist of the hospital, who must render a report on whether or not it was pathological or diseased tissue or normal tissue. All these reports are then scrutinized by the tissue committee. The likelihood of loopholes in surgeons doing gross unnecessary surgery seems very remote to me.
In the search for ways to hold down medical costs, a group of doctors almost 30 years ago organized what, in effect, was a group medical practice. For a flat fee, a family was assured of all its medical needs. This was not insurance, but prepayment. One of the major group medical practices is in Washington, D.C. Charles Woolsey reviewed with two of its spokesmen, Dr. Thomas Arnett and Executive Director Frank C. Waters, the effectiveness of group practice procedures.
In today's world of high cost, the technique of group practice linked with prepayment or budgeting your medical care seems to be the most economical and the best way to get delivery in medical care today.
As some of the things to do to slow down the escalation of prices, I would suggest that we do more of what we have done here at Group Health in the way of avoiding unnecessary hospitalization. I say it's unnecessary because we believe that much of it can be handled on an outpatient basis. This makes the total bill paid for hospitalization less. And as an example, our hospitalization rate for the federal employee is approximately half of what it is under the other two carriers. This is due to the fact that we have completely equipped and staffed outpatient facilities, and we do not admit patients to the hospital just for diagnostic workups. We are all very conscious of the need of hospital beds in the community. We try to conserve them for the sick people.
This group practice technique is a way in which you put under one roof the medical specialties so that you bring about the natural efficiency and effectiveness of working together as against having to walk down the street and work blocks apart. But it just frankly is a better way of doing it.
Medical care as we know it today could not exist without today's skilled nurse. In part, the soaring cost of medical care is on her capable shoulders because her income has trebled in the last 15 years. It still, however, is below the level of the average school teacher. In San Francisco, Bob Lazich of NBC News talked about nursing problems with Leona Conti of the California Nursing Association.
Is one of the problems of nursing poor pay?
Yes, it is. We have made some significant gains here in California in recent years in economic matters, and certainly in other parts of the country, great strides have also been made. But we can identify that there are parts of the country where the shortage would seem to be more acute than here, and where nurse salaries are not competitive with other career opportunities where the responsibility in education is the same. We feel that continuing to keep the salaries at a pace with other salaries so that the field remains appropriately recognized economically will be essential.
Is there a lot of turnover of nurses in any given hospital?
Our research department estimates that the registered nurse turnover in the Bay Area has probably remained relatively stable since 1965 and probably would currently range from perhaps 45% to 50%.
How much of a factor do you think that nurses are in the skyrocketing cost of medical care?
Our interpretation is that it is a relatively small cost of the total medical care item. Perhaps 2% of the overall medical cost goes into nursing personnel in agencies where patients may go at the time they may be sick or cared for.
Almost two-thirds of the nation's families today have some sort of medical insurance. There is a common charge, one which most doctors ignore, that the average patient still pays as much cash in excess of insurance payments as he did 10 years ago. The suspicion is that the insurance pay is pocketed as extra money by the doctor. Insurance seldom pays the full cost of hospitalization. The costs of hospital care have increased at a rate disproportionately higher to the major factors in the economy. Bill Fitzgerald of NBC News, in conversation with J. Douglas Coleman, president of the Associated Hospital Service of New York, asked what the insurers are doing about high hospital costs.
Now, what are we doing about it in Blue Cross? In most areas of the country, we pay hospitals on an audited cost basis. We actually field audit their expenditures and try to evaluate the kinds of services that are actually available to our subscribers and not paying for some of the things that hospitals do that are unrelated to patient care. I think many of us feel that the cost-based reimbursement formula, which has been the standard pattern for the last 10 or 12 years, probably its days are numbered. It does not have sufficient controls. It does not have sufficient incentives for effectiveness and economy. And yet, the minute you begin to put in arbitrary limits on payment, you have to be concerned with the question of quality. There comes a point at which unreasonable limits on payment do realistically affect quality of care. And this is the most difficult of the reimbursement questions.
The most influential organization in medicine is the American Medical Association. The AMA certainly does not rate as highly in the opinion of the average layman as it does with the AMA itself, often being viewed as a sort of super trade union that is chiefly interested not in the ultimate welfare of the patient, but in the ultimate economic well-being of the doctor. In part, this is true, and the AMA would not deny it. But on the other hand, the AMA's views on today's medical problems are serious, thoughtful, and important. Dr. Dwight Wilbur, president of the prestigious AMA, talked about some medical problems with Bob Lazich, NBC News, San Francisco.
Doctor, do you think that the image of the average American doctor has changed in recent years?
The image has changed because medicine has changed and society has changed. The physician depends on many individuals who, some of them very highly trained, to aid him in the care of patients. This is particularly true in hospitals.
The costs of hospitalization, doctors' costs, have all skyrocketed in recent years. What do you think are the biggest factors in this increase in cost?
And this has been due basically to two things. The first is the fact that there is much more sophisticated instrumentation and much more highly trained personnel in the modern hospital. Secondly, the wages of hospital employees have gone up greatly.
Statistics show that doctors' income has doubled in the last 12 years. Do you think that's unreasonable?
Well, I'm not sure where those figures came from. I would personally question this. I'm sure that, as an average, physicians' incomes have increased in the last 10 years, but so have the incomes of all successful professional people in that time.
There's been some criticism that some doctors are using these government programs, Medicare, as a gimmick to charge fees or increase fees where there might be lesser fees in the past.
I think the general trend has been one in which there has been, as I indicated, some increase in fees across the board in recent years, but I doubt if the profession generally has, because of Medicare and Medicaid alone, made a significant increase in the fees for professional services.
Would you say that a lot of people go into the hospital not necessarily because they have to be there, but because they want to take advantage of the hospitalization coverage they have?
Well, this is one of the real keys to the problem, and that is to keep people out of hospitals unless they really need to be there. I think it's important to point out that Blue Cross, when it was established this as a principle, that you go into the hospital, you get your diagnostic studies, it's paid for through the Blue Cross mechanism. This has been well indoctrinated into the public and into the medical profession, and now, unfortunately, it's coming home to roost in a way which is unfortunate, not only for Blue Cross, but for hospitals, for people, for physicians. And it's going to take a number of years yet to get people over the idea that this is the most economical way in which to get their diagnostic studies and other care that can be done out of the hospital.
You say it's unfortunate. In what way, sir?
It's costing hospitals and people through the voluntary health insurance mechanism money.
Dr. Wilbur, would you say there is a shortage of doctors in the United States?
Yes, there is. I don't have any doubt about this. The American Medical Association has been accused of being responsible for this. However, this is not true at all. The American Medical Association has been trying to increase the number of medical schools and the places in medical schools for students.
Doctor, one of the problems in our country, as you no doubt know, is the lack of doctors in rural areas. Does the AMA have any interest in doing something about this?
The AMA, through the efforts of the Sears Roebuck Foundation, has made a concerted effort to place physicians in small rural areas where there were no physicians. The real problem here is that to establish a small office or hospital in a small community is very expensive.
Do you think that the average patient is getting what he pays for?
I think he's getting more than what he pays for. The public now demands more care from physicians than it has at any time in history.
The watchdog of the nation's health is one of the newer great federal departments, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Wilbur Cohen is its boss. Neil Boggs discussed with him medical problems in our confusing age.
Mr. Secretary, could you give us a progress report on Medicare and Medicaid?
Well, I believe that Medicare is going very successfully. It is in its third year now, and many of the dire predictions about how it would operate unsuccessfully have not turned out to be true. No one has been socialized, no one has been regimented, no one has had their medical care interfered with, except they've had some of their bills paid.
Are the doctors more happy with it than they were at the outset?
Yes. We have indicated to the doctors that the government can work with them cooperatively on problems of financing without interfering with the practice of medicine from the standpoint of the diagnosis or treatment.
Has there been any significantly high level of inflated fee claims by doctors?
Well, we've got to remember that Medicare came into operation during a period when prices were rising, and by that I mean all prices were rising. We have had some indications of abuse, which we have tried to correct, but I don't think it has been a situation which calls for a precipitate action which might, in a sense, be worse than the problem itself. I believe that the government has to be very careful about intervening into the price-cost relationship of individual physicians, and I therefore have on several occasions urged physicians to show voluntary restraint in the raising of their fees and their prices.
In most cases, have they been cooperative?
I think many of them are, but I can't say that the matter has been universally accepted.
Do you think they might impose self-restraint as a body to prevent the need for
controls? Well, I don't think it's something that they can do as a body, because the American Medical Association, for instance, doesn't control the individual physicians with regard to the fees he charges any more than any other person does. There has to be some kind of a general recognition on the part of all of the people involved.
Mr. Secretary, about Medicare in the poverty areas, is it reaching as many people there as it should, or as it was intended to reach?
Well, are you speaking of Medicare now or Medicaid?
Medicaid. Excuse me.
Well, Medicaid, of course, didn't get off to as comprehensive a start or as successful a start as Medicare, because in the first place it involves state-by-state action, and not all of the states have come into the program yet, although I would expect all of them to be in by 1970. Secondly, the degree of coverage in these Medicaid programs in the state is dependent upon state action and state financing, and that may vary a good deal, all the way from very comprehensive programs which exist in states like New York and a couple of others to states that don't have any programs at all.
What do you see as the federal government's role in health insurance?
Well, I believe the federal government's role in health insurance is to see that one way or another, through either private or public means, practically all of the population is covered by insurance. And if that can be done through a voluntary arrangement for most of the people, well, that would be fine. But if it can't be done, then I think the federal government's role must be in somehow expanding existing programs to see that every individual, from birth to death, through all forms of medical protection, has a reasonable degree of comprehensive insurance coverage. Once that is done, then I think the federal government also has another role to see that medical care is organized in this country so that people can then have the kind of health protection that their insurance buys them.
One final question, Mr. Secretary. Do you think that the average American is getting the health service that he's paying for?
There's a lot more that he could get for his money if the services were better organized on a more comprehensive group-type basis. I believe that while many, many people in this country are getting excellent care, there's some people who are not getting it all, and some people who are getting very bad medical care.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
It is not our purpose to solve the problems of medical care, its costs, its availability, its quality. But we have heard some alarming facts. Costs are high and are going higher. And obviously, millions of Americans in no doctor and one doctor towns and the slums are far from the quality of medical care which the well-to-do in big cities accept as a matter of daily course. What can be done to stop the dizzy spiral of costs? Costs are going to continue upwards, and faster than the cost of living for the foreseeable future. It may be in this time of national elections, the major political parties could take a few moments out from the other problems and talk about the cost and availability of medicine. It may be that the federal and state governments could give much more substantial income tax relief to those who are ill. It may be that both the government and medical insurance companies must exercise a tougher degree of control over medical payments to doctors and hospitals. And it also may be that the ultimate source of medical care, the doctor, might be satisfied for a little while with his current remarkably high income without attempting to push it any higher. This is Dean Mell, NBC News, New York.
You have been listening to Second Sunday, Medicine, Cost and Care, Part 2. Second Sunday is produced under the control of NBC News. Tonight's program was written and produced by Herbert Gordon, reporter Dean Mell, director Malcolm Bramley, tape editors Walter Ryan and William Tuohy. This is Howard Reed.
This is NBC. NBC Monitor News. Here's Bill Fitzgerald.
At least 15 U.S. B-52 bombers pounded targets inside North Vietnam today. They dropped almost 1 million pounds of bombs in 5 raids, the first in North Vietnam in 3 weeks. The big stratofortresses...